I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, lessons learned from weather disasters and how they impact policy changes. It was a year ago this week that Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast, and among the areas hardest hit were New Jersey and New York. A year earlier, in August of 2011, Hurricane Irene followed a similar path, and while it spared New Jersey and New York for the most part, Connecticut and Vermont were not so lucky. Vermont was spared the worst of Hurricane Sandy, but while the storm was making its way north, the state was getting ready, assembling an incident command center and putting into action lessons learned from a year earlier from Irene. Amy Kolb-Noyes reports from Vermont.
A quiet day, thanks to weakening high pressure, will be followed by deteriorating weather conditions.
By the time Hurricane Irene reached Vermont, it had been downgraded to tropical storm status. Nonetheless, the storm proved to be one of the state's most devastating disasters. Flooding destroyed 1,000 homes in Vermont and took 6 lives. More than a dozen communities were entirely isolated. Iconic covered bridges were ripped from their abutments and whisked downstream. Irene shone a spotlight on many of Vermont's infrastructure weaknesses, and because of this, the state chose to build back stronger. Part of Vermont's response plan was appointing an Irene recovery officer. Sue Minter filled that position before being appointed to her current job, Vermont's Deputy Secretary of Transportation. Minter says when Irene struck, state government chose to be nimble.
We quickly decided that our normal way of doing things wasn't going to work, and we had to drop business as usual and move into a very focused response.
The state established an incident command system to prioritize and coordinate the emergency response. Minter says this system allowed state transportation officials to work side by side with private utility providers, restoring both access and power to isolated communities.
We learned through Irene that we needed to establish unique partnerships, and I think that was one of our hallmarks, is that ability to quickly respond, but also to collaborate.
Minter says the usual way of doing business would not have worked with winter just a few months away.
It's very different from the way things operate when you move a project through many phases that can take years for a piece of infrastructure to get fixed. We only had days, weeks, and ultimately months to get 500 miles of road and 34 state bridges operational by winter.
After last month's severe flooding, officials in Colorado began facing these same challenges. Minter says there were many similarities.
First of all, the rain and flooding event itself was in some ways quite similar. Torrential downfall, but also the fact that they're mountainous terrain, like us, and narrow river valleys, which meant that in many cases roads were quite close to the rivers, and the rain, in addition to the erosion, the runoff from the mountains, meant that many miles of roads were completely taken down. For them, it was 200 miles and 50 bridges.
So when the rain stopped, Minter led a small delegation of Vermonters to Colorado to share some of the lessons learned from Irene. Among the strategies Colorado put in place were establishing an incident command system and placing a disaster recovery staff person in the governor's office. As Vermont's former Irene recovery officer, Minter says she was happy to be able to share some of the lessons she learned firsthand.
It was a very emotional and intense experience to be in Colorado and in some ways reliving the trauma of Irene. But it was also very gratifying to be able to help in any way and to try to be of some use and to help them forecast what is coming and perhaps support their recovery to be as strong as ours.
Minter has also traveled to Washington, D.C. to be part of the disaster response conversation on a federal level. She says Hurricane Sandy was a real eye-opener for federal policymakers.
One of the things we are trying to talk about is how we can, you know, reorient the federal policy after a disaster to not bump up against a state or community's desire to build back stronger, but in fact create more incentives for that. And I think the world has changed post-Sandy.
Vermont ran into heavy resistance in its attempt to rebuild infrastructure to better withstand future disasters. The Federal Emergency Management Agency's policy was to replace what was lost in a disaster. When Vermont asked for money to install a larger culvert or build a flood-resistant state office building, those requests were denied. But Minter says Sandy has changed the way federal policymakers are thinking about disasters. And, she says, more and more of Vermont's funding appeals are being approved. Minter says the tide may be turning on federal funding policies. Recent legislation paved the way for a pilot FEMA program that will allow Vermont to replace its state office complex, destroyed by Irene, with a new structure built to withstand the next disaster. I'm Amy Kolb-Noyes, reporting from Vermont.
Joining us in studio, WCAI science editor and host of Living Lab, Dr. Heather Goldstone. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
In a few minutes, nature writer David Gessner will join us to look at the question of why rebuild when this is likely to happen again. And later in the hour, Ryan Bennett from the Cape Cod Commission will talk about ways to become more resilient to storm surge and flooding in our region. Heather, in Amy's report, she brings up some interesting points on this idea of building back stronger rather than just replacing. And we should say we were very lucky because had that storm take a little bit more turn to the right, this could be us.
Right. I mean, we certainly did see a little bit of damage. I actually just drove down Surf Drive here in Falmouth. And of course, we saw part of that wash out and have to be rebuilt. But for the most part, we were spared most of it. But I think what we did get with Sandy to some degree is we got a preview of what certain storms might be like 10 or 20 years in the future, because if you recall, it hit during high tide, and in fact, astronomically high tides, so unusually high tides. And that kind of gives you a sense of how much worse the flooding and the storm surge and all of the wave action is if we had base sea level having risen 6 feet or a foot or 2 feet, because that's what we were seeing in terms of extra water during Sandy. And certainly, you know, I think it was for a lot of people, it was kind of a glimpse of the future and a real wake up call.
Yeah. And then this idea of building back stronger, though, as Amy was saying, you know, the federal, you know, policy was, no, we replace what's been destroyed. And Sandy's a big lesson here to go, well, you know, maybe that's not such a good policy.
Yeah. You know, I think Sandy was definitely a wake-up call. I think that in part for the Northeast, Sandy might not have been as much of a wake-up call if Irene hadn't hit the year before and Earl the year before that. We had 3 years where we'd each fall seen a hurricane come right up the coast and hit some part of New England with some degree of damage. And, you know, Irene, New York got spared the worst of it, but they still had parts of the commuter rail that were shut down. They did see some flooding impacts from Irene. And I think, you know, with one off, they were able to say, oh, well, that's just one time. We'll just rebuild. We'll just keep going. And Sandy hit the next year. And suddenly they couldn't just say, oh, it was only one time. And so they needed to think about this idea of you've got to build stronger, or even think about the option of not rebuilding, which I think that was a real difference. If you go back to like Katrina in New Orleans, the rhetoric after that was entirely rebuild, rebuild, rebuild. And in the immediate aftermath of Sandy, when everybody was still pretty traumatized, you've already got the mayor of New York saying, we might not be rebuilding after this one.
We're going to talk to Dave about that in a second. But first, I also want to bring up, and you're touching on this, there's a lot of people say, hey, this doesn't happen that often. It's the 100-year storm, you know, every 100 years. But indications are that we will be seeing severe or disruptive weather patterns going forward.
Well, and already are. In fact, it was just over a month ago that the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their most recent report on the state of climate science. And basically the headline for that was there's incontrovertible evidence that climate change is happening. We are now 95 to 100% certain that it's primarily human caused, and it's already affecting the weather. We're already seeing extreme events that are more extreme. Not that hurricanes are caused by climate change. Mm-hmm. Clearly they aren't.
Right.
But the analogy, and it's very apropos this week, is compare baseball with and without steroids. Mm. Right? You're going to have baseball anyway, and you're going to have home runs. But when you've got players on steroids, you're going to get a lot more home runs. So you put the weather system juiced by climate change, and you're going to get a lot more of these extreme events.
Right. Let's bring nature writer and Professor David Gessner into the conversation. He joins us on the phone from his office at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Good morning, David.
Morning, Mindy.
All right, you wrote a piece for the November issue of Outside Magazine that looks at the work of Orrin Pilkey. He is for many years a coastal geologist at Duke University. He's a professor emeritus and the author of numerous books. He's been saying for 30 years we should not be building on the shore, and he's made it his life's mission to oppose shoreline construction, is adamantly opposed to rebuilding after hurricanes. Tell us why.
Well, he believes that well, first of all, to give a little Cape Cod reference, I moved down here from the Cape 10 years ago, and I had a 3-month-old with me, my daughter, and decided that as the hurricanes started hitting one after another, I'd better learn about hurricanes. Mm. And I did a search, and I talked to people, and Orrin's name kept coming up. And as you say, he's been pushing against rebuilding on the coast down here for years and along the Jersey Shore, which he calls a giant science experiment. And one of the reasons is he sees that by building up and defending the beaches, as we do, you know, you don't see it as much on the Cape, but you see it in Jersey and you see it in North Carolina. By building walls, you end up destroying the slope and pulse of the beach. And then there's no defense when the storms do come. And even if you have a wall, once the wall is topped, the destruction is even worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, my mind, I had a set thing I was going to say to you, but my mind is so crackling from the things that Heather said and that Sue Minter said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one was I spent 7 years in Boulder, Colorado, and I thought the same thing about the flooding, but also the wildfires. You see all these parallels with these weather patterns changing. And the wildfires, the same cries to rebuild are going on out there right after, even though you're building in the way of the dangerous places. Orrin Pilkey says of the beach, mm-hmm. you know, if you rebuild on a train track, you can't be surprised when the train comes.
Right, exactly. Heather, Heather, maybe you can explain to us, you know, what happens when you have, you know, jetties and seawalls and then how that interrupts the natural flow of the sand. And
yeah, well, I mean, we've got some great examples here on Cape Cod. For all that David says it's worse further down south, it may be. We actually did here in Massachusetts basically ban armoring the coast, putting these hard structures right along the coast back in the 70s. But of course, we still have a legacy of that. We have probably $1 billion worth of rebuilding to do just to keep up the seawalls that are already there. And the problem is that when you put a jetty or a seawall or any of these hard structures, basically the way that beaches are maintained is the idea that whether it's a barrier beach or more like the Cape, where we're not actually a barrier beach, we have actually glacial rocks underneath us in terms of the geology. The beaches are really in the way Mother Nature intended is those beaches would move. And so sand moves from one beach along the shore to other beaches. Take the example of Falmouth, Nobsco Point, all along Surf Drive and Falmouth Heights, which folks from around the region might know, you know, where the ferries mm-hmm. are coming in. All of that area is really meant to be basically a donor of sand for the whole rest of Falmouth, almost all the way over to Hyannis, moving eastward. Same thing on the Outer Cape. There's kind of an inflection point midway up the national seashore where waves hit and sand either moves south, and that's what feeds the whole barrier beach system in Chatham, or else that's what's building the other half of the sand moves north and goes up towards Provincetown. And that's really what's building Provincetown. Provincetown is essentially a sandbar. And so this sand is constantly shifting. And when you put these hard structures in place, it may hold the line in one place, but in fact, erosion of that very same beach gets worse, and it starves the rest of the coastline of that sand, and so you see erosion in other places mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And I could give Heather, I can give a real specific example on the Outer Banks where you see, you know, these basically trophy homes that are out on sandbars, and they put up sandbags, mm-hmm. which is great; they're defending themselves. But because of downdrift erosion, they're attacking their down coast neighbor,
right,
and then
right.
they have to put up sandbags, and then it keeps moving along. So, you know, Orrin is specifically against that sort of defense. He's also adamantly against the building of any high rises, because while we've seen, you know, these nightmare scenarios in the last few years, imagine it hitting Florida, where you can't move a high rise and you can't back up. And he's also, you know, kind of always yelling the word retreat, which, as I say, sounds very unmanly to to residents.
Yeah.
And also kind of unrealistic. I mean, one of the parts of the article is, having grown up on the beaches on the Cape, I feel a real attachment and understanding of the appeal of living by water, whereas he lives 3 hours inland and rails against living by water. But I think a lot of his ideas, one of the fascinating things about the trip, was there really has been a consciousness shift. You don't see too many practical results, but for instance, in late Irene, early Sandy, you started to see the Weather Channel use words like climate change and sea level rise. You see that Christie is pushing for dunes rather than hard armaments. Now, dunes have their own problems. One problem is they give a false sense of security. If your barrier island is 8 feet tall and there's going to be a 7 foot sea level rise, you know, once the dune is topped, the island is washed out.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that people are talking about the things that Orrin has been talking about for decades, and that this is a change. And there's been, you know, with Bloomberg you mentioned, and Cuomo with the home buyouts, which aren't, you know, they're not really people aren't really going for it. But
well, it depends. At least what I've heard is that Staten Island, they're actually oversubscribed. Rockaway, they're not really going for it. So I think it kind of depends where you are. But Staten Island got hit so hard, both Irene and then Sandy as well, lives lost there. And they actually have neighborhoods that are saying, we want in on the buyouts, and they don't have the money for it.
Yeah, and you know, the analogy I was thinking of just this morning is the national seashores. I was walking. I hadn't realized until I moved down here that Ocracoke, you know, National Seashore preceded ours. But I was walking along, and I had 3 miles. I didn't see anybody two Novembers ago. And I saw this local guy fishing, and I went up to talk to him. And I, you know, talked about the history of the island. And he said his grandparents had been enraged when the government came in to, you know, buy out the land that they'd had for generations. And then he pointed around and said, but you can't argue with the result.
Right.
And so maybe there's a way. I mean, I don't see a mass retreat from the Jersey Shore.
No.
But maybe this can be part of the dialogue. You know, I like the line, build back stronger, but I'd prefer build back smarter.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's probably really the point. And you know, a lot of the scientists that I've spoken to over the years about this issue say we really have three choices, right? And the science can't tell us which one to do. We have to make some value judgments. So Oren Pilkey's made the value judgment. We should just completely retreat and we shouldn't be there. And that's one option.
And it's good to have that as a poll to kind of have the dialogue.
Yeah. Right. But then another option is that you can build more smartly, more intelligently along the coast. And I think one great example is the Cape Cod National Seashore here has to rebuild one of their bathhouses that is right along the coast. Seawall that essentially has been there for decades has crumbled, and they're getting rid of that. And they're figuring once they get rid of that seawall, they're going to lose tens of feet of shoreline, and that beach house is basically going to be in the water, and it's outdated anyway. So in the conversations about replacing it, there were some who were advocating, well, the beach bathhouse needs to not be right on the beach. It needs to be way back so that we can take into account the fact that the beach is going to move. And in the end, what they decided was, well, that doesn't really serve the purpose of having a bathhouse at the beach. And so instead, what they've built into the plans is the fact that this beach house can essentially be mobile, that it's something that will be easy to basically pick up and move back as they need to, that it won't be the, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars that it would take to move a traditional building. And so they've taken it into account in a creative way, not saying we're going to completely retreat, but not saying we're going to hold the line either.
Yeah, that's I'm a believer in the kung fu philosophy of the beach. Like we pulse and go with it rather than fight back. For instance, when we were touring the Jersey Shore in February, I witnessed what I was calling the North Carolinization of Jersey, because suddenly you're getting these houses forced by insurance to build on stilts so that the water flows below.
Mm. You know, David, it was 4 years ago you traveled with Dr. Pilkey to New York City, and he described what would happen if a hurricane hit New York. Did his predictions match up with what happened, and what does he think about the possibility of future storms?
They did pretty much to the subway stop, but it wasn't, you know, it was a unique storm. It was a big storm. It was two different weather systems. But what it didn't have that he had predicted was just sheer wind, which, you know, you suddenly have falling glass and you have a whole other element of disaster. And, you know, and I think that one of the positive things, not to get too positive here, is the awareness that with heated oceans, we're going to see more of that in New England. I mean, here it's old hat. We've seen it before.
Yeah.
And, you know, just simple things like that we were in pretty far downtown, and in the place we'd been, we saw the watermark 7 feet high up on the buildings, and we talked to a store owner who said the mannequins from Abercrombie and Finch were floating in the sewage-filled water. So, I mean, and this without, as I say, without the winds.
Yeah. One of the other things you sort of touched on was Governor Christie's executive order to try to protect the entire Jersey Shore with sand dunes. First of all, the cost just sounds really prohibitive.
Yeah.
But what is...
We haven't even talked about the overall cost yet.
I would assume it's got to be something similar to we see here with the beach nourishment, you know, projects. It's temporary.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, that's why it's better. You know, it's not a... It's not, you know, something there is that doesn't like a wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a wall that's going to destroy, but it's temporary. And with those barrier islands, some of which are made out of dredge to begin with, it's really, at its worst, it's an excuse for, you know, same old, go back to business. the mayor on Jaws, the water's fine, come on back, sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's like Heather, you said, it's that false sense of security, too.
Right, but it's also, you know, like we were saying, that we've got kind of these three options. You can retreat, you can try to build and more smartly and do some of these beach nourishment and temporary things, or you can try to just hold the line and you can armor and you can rebuild and you can rebuild. None of those is cheap. This is this is not going to there's no free lunch here, right?
Right.
So we've got to make some really tough decisions about how we're going to spend our money. Do we want to be at the coast and just keep dumping sand because hoping that that sand will protect the properties and we won't be rebuilding, but we'll be constantly having to put more sand back to replace it? You know, that's one option. And I think what we've seen change a lot since Sandy is the fact that more of these options are on the table, and we're starting to have those hard conversations that we need to have.
Yeah. So,
the other one we have to have a hard conversation about is federal flood insurance and these emergency, you know, these politically motivated. I mean, think of the uproar when people dragged their feet a little on the Sandy relief bill. You know, but $50 billion for this, you know, in the times we are, and $50 billion for the next one, and this automatic response. And a lot of it, I really appreciated what Sue Minter was saying, but a lot of it isn't smart rebuilding. It's reflexive rebuilding.
Yeah.
And I could picture, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot in the last week. I can picture, you know, we're not going to all retreat from the beach, but I can picture places where we national seashore and we say, this is a danger zone, or where we really look at the flood maps and say, we're going to buy out this place, and here we're going to put dunes, and here we're not going to put dunes. We're going to let the marsh pulse. So I could, you know, I'm not saying, I mean, we're not all that enlightened, and it's kind of against human nature to be smart and think ahead, but there are possibilities there.
Yeah. We are talking about lessons learned from weather disasters and how they impact policy changes. We'd love to hear what you think. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Heather, I can't help but think, as David was talking there, and we've talked about this, Surf Drive. I mean, that beach has eroded to a point that, I mean, where else in the country do you drive down a road and the beach is literally, I mean, what is it, maybe 10 feet?
Well, I drove in along Surf Drive, and this is actually kind of a habit of mine that I started a couple of years ago, that I try to drive either into Woods Hole or out of Woods Hole via Surf Drive every day that I come to work, just as kind of a reminder of where we are. And then when we have these major events, you can see how much it changes. And, you know, what we see on Surf Drive is that, yeah, at high tide at this point, you know, your husband was saying when he was growing up around here, there used to be 200 feet of beach on Surf Drive. And now you drive Surf Drive and at high tide, the water's pretty much lapping at the road. And we did have to rebuild about a quarter mile of the road last year after storm damage. And I noticed the other day that the road is already crumbling again. It's already being undercut because there's just no beach there. We've basically got a road that's almost a road over water. And in Falmouth, there's an interesting situation because we have so many scientists that work here in town that are involved in town governance. And 8 years ago, actually, it was more like 10 or 12 years ago, this working group was put together to draft a coastal management plan for Falmouth. And it was 8 years ago that they finished the plan for the south-facing coast. And basically what they said is, as David was just referring to, that this area along Surf Drive is one of those areas where we need to make the hard choice to retreat, to let this go back to natural habitat so that it can be the sand source for the rest of Falmouth's beaches so that they can be more resilient. And what that means is letting go of about a dozen of those little, you know, basically dune shacks that are out there, and also that road. But there's also infrastructure under there. There's a sewer line that comes down to Woods Hole. There's the bike path. So there's a lot of things that we have to think about. And just facing up to that one situation is difficult enough that what we're still seeing is the instant a quarter mile of the road gets washed away. I mean, instantaneously,
right,
within days, they were out there rebuilding it. There was clearly no stop and think there. It was just a very reflexive rebuild response. And so I think that speaks to how hard it is to come to
this area in the country. you know what I mean? You guys have the brains there to do it. And at most local places, that's one of Warren's main things is, if you let local people make these decisions on these places, I mean, you understand why you do, you sympathize, but if you do, they're never going to say, well, we're going to retreat.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I guess I have a different perspective on that, because I think at the same time, it's easy for somebody to sit in Washington and try to make policies, but they're very removed from it. And the beach superintendents around Cape Cod are seeing this happen. They can't really stick their heads in the sand, pardon the pun, because they're seeing this happen and they have to deal with it on a daily basis. And so in some ways, I think there's no better place to deal with it than on the local level.
I would say that. And as we look ahead at ways to become more resilient to storm surge and flooding, the Cape Cod Commission is proposing new land designations called priority protection areas. And joining us on the phone to talk about these proposed land designations is Ryan Bennett from the Planning Community Development Department at the Cape Cod Commission. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
All right, so tell us, what are these priority protection areas?
Well, the priority protection areas will be rolled out as part of our 2014 Regional Policy Plan update. The Regional Policy Plan is a document that we update every 5 years here at the Commission, so we're due for an update. And as part of that planning document, we have a land use vision mapping process. It was something that was also begun about 5 years ago, where we designated certain resource areas, village-style development patterns across the Cape. We worked with towns to create those maps. As we sort of dust off that old process and begin to look at new designation areas, we've put a heightened focus on our coastal zones. And in these priority protection areas, we would be proposing to take a closer look at land that is subject to coastal storm flowage, land that is subject to storm surge, as well as, you know, just our resources, coastal resources, barrier beaches, salt marshes, wetlands, vernal pools, et cetera. So we're hoping to pull all that together into these priority protection areas, have some conversations through a workshop process with the public, which we would invite people to participate, and try to focus our planning efforts on the coastal zone.
So on these areas, these would be regions that you would try to remain undeveloped, or if they have some development, maybe like we're talking the road, Surf Drive, they're letting it go back to its natural state?
I think we'd focus on undeveloped land in the coastal zone to start the discussion, and then see where it takes us from there. But these would be pretty broad categories at first.
Yeah. So, and you also facilitate regional hazard mitigation planning for the various towns on the Cape, and having those plans in place means that the towns are eligible for FEMA grants, right?
Yes. And I do, to pick up on an earlier comment, I think those plans, the local plans in particular, are a great stop and think moment for the communities here on the Cape. There are five towns that have certified FEMA plans. Having a certified plan allows you to access two pots of federal funds. One is pre-disaster mitigation funds, another is post-disaster declaration funding opportunities. And through the planning process, you sit down with a local planning committee and conduct a risk and vulnerability assessment where you really look at your community, where your critical facilities are, what's vulnerable according to both flood plain data as well as storm surge data, and you can even consider sea level rise data as part of that process if you want to take it that far. So it's a very useful exercise for local communities to understand their vulnerabilities, develop a mitigation strategy, and then pursue federal funds to implement those projects.
Ryan, have you found that some of these towns are surprised when they go through where their vulnerable areas are?
Some of them are, yes. We have found that there are firehouses in the floodplain, and now with new floodplain data out, that's become a bit of a game changer. There are more properties, both commercial, municipal, and residential, located in the floodplain.
Yeah, we talked about these new floodplain maps, and it was interesting because I know in some of these public hearings, people have said, well, you know, there's never been this, my house has never been flooded, and they've brought some old timers to say, well, yeah, I can remember, even though it was a long time ago, that some of these areas have been flooded, and it's just recent memory. We don't remember that.
I think one of the interesting things about those FEMA maps is the fact that, you know, we think of them as this is the update, this is the most, and you're saying, you know, this is new information almost to a lot of people that maybe haven't been in the region for long enough to have seen these less frequent floods. But they actually only are basically catching up to what's already happened. So we've already seen sea level rise a foot in the past century. And so these maps are catching up to what's already happened, but they very explicitly do not include any future projections. So there's an argument there to be made that while we're catching up by adopting these new FEMA flood maps, we're not still really incorporating the full vulnerability that we face going forward.
So Ryan, where are we in mapping sea level rise for the Cape? I mean, is that something that's happening?
It's something that's been happening for a while in terms of these bathtub approaches. And I think here at the Commission we've held off in trying to take that approach because it the Cape's coastline is so dynamic. And it's, as you were mentioning earlier, sand is constantly shifting. So the bathtub model may not accurately reflect our vulnerability to sea level rise here. The approach we're trying to take is with all this new LIDAR data, better elevation data that's out there, this more refined topographic data, there's an opportunity to work from that. The FEMA maps are based on better elevation data and may have a more accurate depiction of where the water is going. I think that's where you see these old-timers saying, oh, actually, this may be more accurate. It reflects the conditions, the topography on the ground better. So building off of that, if we know where the water or have a better sense of where the water is going, I think we can begin to think about sea level rise projections and look at elevations beyond those boundaries and just try to understand vulnerability from that sense.
I think one of the things that's always really interesting to me is how little we have known about how the coast works. It was in the 70s that Massachusetts decided to ban seawalls and other armoring because we were getting the idea that, this has repercussions that honestly had never even entered anyone's mind that if you put up this armoring in one place, it's going to starve beaches further down the coast. And to this very day, we're still learning brand new things. Scientists at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution learning new things about what happens when a wave overtops a dune. Literally just that physical process and how the dune changes when it gets overtopped versus how it gets flooded or when there's a break in it, these different physical processes and how that changes the coast. And that's stuff that we're still trying to understand. Mm-hmm. So we actually have a decent handle in terms of the climate science and how much sea level is going to rise. But then translating that, as Ryan was saying, into what's that going to mean for our coasts is something that we're still figuring out. We can pretend that the whole world is a bathtub and that as the sea level rises, the water level just goes up like it does in your bathtub, but that's not what happens.
Right.
Some places get bigger, some places the beach moves, some places, the marsh changes shape, and so that really changes what your flooding looks like. And we're still, I would say, not infancy, but still early days in really getting a good mechanistic understanding of what's going on at the coast and what that means.
If you take a very specific example, like Long Beach Island, where all the roads were built to basically be inlets and wading from shore to bayside. And, they were built to inundate the island, basically, unintentionally. So a smart road doesn't usher water across an island. It's like a sandbar, when kids run their feet across it and make little canals and flood the sandbar as the tide's coming in. I mean, that's exactly what happened in the islands in Long Beach. And I just want to return for a sec, because every book I've written has been about local places and love of the local. So slightly defensively, Heather, I want to say, I totally understand and appreciate that. I guess what I had in mind was down here, thinking of Oren Pilkey and watching what's happened on the Outer Banks, where you see a third generation of houses down on sandbars, and hurricanes come and wipe them out. And then, as Oren said, it's instantly an urban renewal project pushed by the business community and the real estate community instantly. And there hasn't been reflection down here. I know the Cape is a different place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and North Carolina has had the national spotlight shown on it in the past year or so, with the whole idea of there was an attempt at the state level to create a plan, and that actually was at first heralded as being very progressive and forward looking, because it was actually largely based on the projection of up to 39 inches of sea level rise by 2100, which is right around the upper bound of kind of the consensus on what we should probably expect, but not out of the realm of what we should expect in the coming decades. That, of course, freaked a lot of people out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of businesses in particular got very concerned about that. And so you then saw the state legislators from 20 coastal counties that said they were going to be economically impacted the hardest by the development constraints that were being imposed by this development plan come back and actually put into place legislation that says no development planning going forward will do anything more than essentially adopt the historic rate of sea level change. So we've seen, you know, we have the average over the past 100 years, but really what we've seen in the past 30 years is that that rate has started to accelerate. So they actually put into law the fact that sea level rise. Right, you can't take into account the acceleration. The headlines have been they've outlawed sea level rise. They haven't outlawed sea level rise completely. They've outlawed accelerating sea level rise.
Well, they're doing a lot of other stuff down here too, but another great local example is Norfolk, where you have where they've kind of skipped over the whole conservative liberal thing, and the mayor there is preparing because they flood at even smaller storms. And you also have the U.S. Naval Base where they're raising docks and they're proceeding along the logical, practical line that sea level rise is going to come at the rate that scientists predict, not the rate the legislature.
Brian, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, where does Massachusetts stand in terms of hazard planning and vulnerability?
Oh, good question. I think we're ahead of the curve. I know that a lot of the regional planning agencies throughout the state assist their localities with these hazard mitigation plans. I think all of these planning processes are starting to try and incorporate climate change science and climate adaptation strategies. So I think there's certainly much more that we could be doing, but we have 5 towns within the Cape that have certified plans. We have a regional certified plan, and we have a grant into FEMA to develop 5 additional plans in the region. So we're making progress.
Right.
Yeah, I would definitely say that compared to other places, especially if you take the example of North Carolina that we were just talking about, but certainly Massachusetts seems to be ahead of the curve in general climate mitigation and adaptation plans for the state and particularly this coastal issue.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan Bennett from the Planning and Community Development Department at the Cape Cod Commission. Ryan, thanks for joining us this morning. We appreciate
thanks
your time.
So much. My pleasure.
Absolutely. Heather, talk a little bit about the sea level rise and the climate science. I know, and I'll let David chime in here too. I know that we get this figure of what it's going to be, but then you talk to some of the science that came from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But when you talk to individual scientists, that number varies so much.
Well, and what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change most recent report. What all of those reports do is they're not new science. They are a synthesis of all of the science that's out there and trying to represent what is the state of our knowledge. And so they do present this whole range. And they spend a lot of time really trying to pin down how certain we are about certain things. And so what they said in this most recent report is that we are very likely to see somewhere between 1 foot and 3 feet of sea level rise by 2100. That's a pretty big range. Mm-hmm. The most likely figure is somewhere in between those and probably more in the 2 to 3 feet range. You talk to individual scientists that are studying glacial melting, that are studying sea level rise, and they'll tell you in a lot of cases they're actually thinking it's going to be 3+ feet, that we're looking at least a meter by 2100. And I think that's been the case all along, is that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, particularly since this became such a hot-button political issue, has always attempted to be as conservative as possible, mm-hmm. and in a lot of cases gets criticized by other scientists for being too conservative. So I would say 2 to 3 feet absolutely is what we should be expecting. We may see more than that by 2100. And keep in mind, that means that if we see 2 or 3 feet by 2100, we're seeing as much as a foot of sea level rise by 2050. And that's what we've seen over the past century.
Wow.
And here in New England, we have to also keep in mind that the whole world, like we said, is not a bathtub. In addition to glaciers melting and water getting warmer and expanding, these really global processes, we have more local processes that affect sea level rise. And so here in New England, our ground is still kind of sinking as this process of the whole continent rising and falling as the weight of the glaciers has been taken off. So we're still we're falling a little bit at this point. Plus, we also have some really interesting impacts on ocean circulation, that it looks like what we might expect is to see the Gulf Stream actually slow down a little bit. And what the Gulf Stream does as it goes past the Gulf of Maine is essentially kind of sucks some water out away from the coast. And as that slows down, we're going to see more water piling up along the coast. So we have a couple of these local processes, meaning that the New England area could see several inches more sea level rise than that global average of 2 to 3 feet.
David, you want to add anything?
Yeah, just that it's interesting to me. I'm not saying Heather's not doing this, but I always hear by 2100 as if time stops then. and you know,
if only
if we think ahead, well, it might, yeah. Mm-hmm. as I think of my daughter's daughter or mm-hmm. or beyond, I mean, this stuff is. I'm not smart enough to be a scientist, but I'm smart enough to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And even if we take the more conservative estimates, it in certain places like the Barrier Islands here, I mean, 3 feet starts to do in a lot of the Barrier Islands here.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Orrin works with 7 as his working figure. He doesn't call it a prediction. And, I mean, he's more in the Jim Hansen camp, where he has defined himself as a scientific advocate now, more than a scientist, where his job is to get out there and kind of be the megaphone for others, you know, and fight the fight. But he uses 7 feet, and, you know, it's a high number.
It's a scary number, yeah. We're talking about lessons learned from weather disasters and how they impact policy changes with nature writer David Gessner and WCAA science editor and host of Living Lab, Heather Goldstone. 866-999-4626. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Joel writes in from Brewster, the root of the problem is the size of the population. You can't back up from the shore. People are already stepping on each other. Until we address reducing our population, the rest of these discussions don't matter.
Well, I got a note from a woman in Nebraska after the Outside piece came out and said, we're losing population out here. Send some of those coastal people our way.
Heather, you wanted to say
there
something?
You go. Sounds like a plan. Well, I was just going to say, you know, when we're talking about sea level rise and we've spent most of an hour here mostly talking about beaches, and I think that's what gets most of the public attention and I guess has the most charisma. But especially as we're talking about these big numbers of feet of sea level rise, we have a lot of salt marshes here, mm-hmm. and salt marshes play a vital role in protecting what's behind them. They are sponges, they're water filters, they're storm barriers, they're all of these things. And they're, of course, affected both by the sand starvation issue. So we see this very much in Sandwich with Town Neck mm-hmm, Beach and the marsh behind it. The marshes, as sea level rises, as long as it rises at a slow enough pace, the marshes will typically build to keep pace with that. But scientists are saying we don't really know what marshes can handle exactly, but the sense that we're getting is that we are right at the very edge of how quickly marshes can build. And so as sea level continues to rise, even if it's still only, you know, these fractions of an inch each year that sea level is rising, we're hitting a tipping point where marshes may not be able to keep up, and we'll start to see our marshes inundated, and that's going to be another major point of vulnerability.
Yeah. Let me build on that, too. When I started my trip with Orrin Pilkey, we started North Carolina and drove to New York. We started 3 hours inland, and we went through the lowlands of North Carolina, which were still an hour and a half from shore, and he was saying, you know, people talk about the beaches, and a lot of the wealthy people are at the beaches, but this is underwater at 6 feet, where we were still an hour and a half from the shore in the lowlands. So though I agree with the person who emailed in, it may not be a choice at some point as far as backing up.
Yeah. What's the responsibility of the individual homeowners who decide to rebuild on the coast?
Orrin's line is, if you stay, you pay. That has not been the case historically. If you stay, you get paid. But, I mean, that's one of the big questions is, should there reach a point where, you know, there is not an instant funneling of federal money and federal insurance money. Yeah. And that's where Orrin's, again, on the extreme side of things.
And I think that's where kind of this local versus federal and all of the, you know, levels in between, where you start to see this is going to have to be a national conversation. The local government and officials and the people who live there are the people on the ground and seeing it happen, but of course can't handle the economics on their own. And so we're going to have a broader conversation as a nation about how we want to handle this kind of vulnerability, because everybody is going to be helping to pay for it, whether it's buying out the properties or nourishing beaches or building seawalls or rebuilding homes. Any of those options, we're all going to be paying into.
And all of those options are expensive.
And all of them are expensive.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I'm going to take it to kind of an artsy philosophical level, which is, this all started for me on the Cape, and I always go back to listening to John Hay talk about seeing Henry Beston's cabin float out to sea. You know, I'm going to get my dates wrong. I've been gone from New England so long. Is it 78, the storm, or is it 79?
I believe it was 78.
I think it was 78, yeah.
So he watched it float out to sea, and I always think this kind of wild uncertainty of living on the water that's always historically been there. And when Orrin and I drove past Corson's Inlet, which is a beach on New Jersey, I remember the poem by that name where he says, firm ground is not available ground, and no humbling of reality to precept. I mean, who would have thought that Vermont would be the place hardest hit by Irene?
Yeah. You
know, there's so much unpredictability here. And I don't know where to go with that other than, you know, when Oren's saying, this is the way it is, I partly agree with him and say, yes, this is the way it is, but then there's this.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I think you raise a really good point that we've been focusing on the coastal vulnerabilities because that's what we have around here. That's our version of vulnerability. But of course, extreme weather is not limited to hurricanes that hit the coast. We just saw the flooding in Colorado. And even when it is a hurricane or at least a superstorm, Sandy kind of situation, we saw damage in Vermont. I think essentially every state in the United States has, and all around the world, has its vulnerabilities to climate change and to extreme weather. They manifest in different ways. And so everybody's going to have to grapple with this in some form or another. Obviously, it's not erosion when you're in Nebraska, but you've got drought and you've got wildfire. Mm-hmm. You've got different things to contend with.
It's been interesting for me because I'm working on a book about the West and to see the people, you know, to see how in the Southwest climate change is already there and to see these historic droughts and to see other than extreme coastal areas, the most impacted area in our country is the Southwest, and to see the parallels between the two, and just to think in terms of kind of a natural history of the way the world is now, the new world, and to, you know, I don't know if I'm going to come up with administrative solutions, but I do know that what we're seeing is startling, and it really has a great effect on me emotionally as well as just, you know, kind of personally living on the beach.
Yeah. I also wonder, too, if when we have storms like this and there's so much attention, if it changes the way people feel about climate change.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it certainly did, this one. Yeah. I mean, and it hit the world's media epicenter, so finally it was time to believe.
Well, and I think, you know, if you look at the numbers, Yale University has a running study that they go back 3-4 times a year and assess different aspects of public opinion on climate change. And what is interesting is that it wasn't necessarily Sandy that had the biggest impact on public opinion about climate change that year. So 2012, if you even go back and start it with Irene a year before that, 2012 was the most extreme weather year on record, some of the highest damages that the United States has seen between heat waves and the extreme winter that we had in 2012 and then kind of finishing up the year with Sandy and then the winter storm that happened, you know, in February of that of the following year, 2013. So all through 2012, looking at public opinion numbers, in particular, looking at whether or not people said that they thought climate change was impacting weather now. The numbers for that rose and rose and rose through 2012.
And you rarely get the conservative arguments that you got just 5 years ago.
Yeah. But what's interesting is also that we humans are very fickle. When it's hot out, we think climate change is happening. When there's extreme weather, we think climate change is happening. By April of 2013, less than 6 months after Sandy, already those numbers had dropped some. I wouldn't say they necessarily dropped all the way back to pre-2012 numbers. We still have almost 60% of Americans now think climate change is changing our weather.
Quarters, for instance, the firefighters who, if you polled them in 2001 during the Colorado fires, wouldn't acknowledge that climate change was part. Everybody out there is aware that that's part of the, I mean, everybody's an overstatement. That's not a statistic, but people are aware that that's playing a huge role. And the lack of snow, you know, when you don't have a snowpack and you're going to have the fires. So
I have to say, when I went and actually looked at those statistics from the Yale University study, I was actually a little surprised at how much the backslide had been and that it was, I guess, only 60% of Americans that now think climate change is impacting weather, because I agree on a qualitative, just talking to people and the feel of things, it has felt very different in the past year. That conversation has felt very different.
Heather, we mentioned the Cape Cod National Seashore, and it's one of four Northeast coastal parks to participate in a $2.4 million coastal inventory mapping project. What's that all about?
Well, so they're going to be doing some mapping, and it's actually focused on underwater mapping, basically, mm-hmm. saying that, you know, I think it's something like 35%. I can't remember the exact figure, but a large part of essentially the National Seashore's holdings are underwater. And I think this goes back to this point of how new our understanding of coastal processes really is. Mm-hmm. If you look at aerial shots of Cape Cod National Seashore, especially when the water's nice and clear, what you can see just off of the Great Beach is actually these parallel lines that look kind of light underwater. Mm. And there's usually three or four of them spaced out off the coast that are basically underwater sandbars. Mm. And so part of what the point here is to get a sense of what is our sand reservoir that is not sitting on the beach, but is sitting just off the beach. Because as our understanding has evolved, we've started to understand that, well, it may be that first or second kind of wave of sand that's just offshore that can either be pushed onto shore to help build the beach if we have the right weather conditions, or that can basically be those mm-hmm. underwater reservoirs can be mm-hmm. really depleted by storms and pushed offshore, and the impact that those yeah. that underwater habitat has on what we see on the beach.
That's so interesting. So, David, greater lessons that we take away from Hurricane Sandy, what are we learning from it?
Well, for me, the biggest thing is I'm going to try to really not be, and this has been evolving for me in the last few days. I mean, obviously, we've talked about the consciousness raising and that people are more aware of climate change's role. We've seen concrete examples like the Cuomo home buyouts and Bloomberg acknowledging climate change. But what does this mean? You know, what it means for Cape Cod is different from what it means for Jersey. I mean, they've got this long history of arming the beaches. I don't know. I guess what it means is I'm for the embracing of dunes, even though I know dunes aren't a long-term solution for islands that are 7 feet mm-hmm. off the ground. I mean, a 7 feet altitude. But I would love to see a national discussion about reclaiming areas in the style of a national seashore that could be, you know, with home buyouts mm-hmm. that could be used to defend the coast.
Yeah, 30 seconds, Heather.
I don't know if it's more optimistic or less optimistic. I don't know that we're ever going to completely solve this problem and close the book on it, but I would say that the lesson we've taken out of this is that we can't ignore it, and the conversations are starting to happen, and that it's unfortunate that it takes this kind of event to prompt that, but that in and of itself, you know, to quote G.I. Joe, knowing is half the battle. So so just that knowledge, that awareness, and that conversation starting, I think, is a major step forward.
All right. Nature writer David Gessner, who joined us from his office at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Thanks, David, for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Mindy.
And Heather Goldstone, our science editor here at WCAI. Thank you, Heather.
My pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.